Dream murder. And that happened nearly a year after the footage of him kneeling on George Floyd's neck shocked everyone in the world.
Today, you have the cameras all around the world to see and show what happened to my brother. It was a motion picture, the world seeing his life being extinguished. And I could do nothing but watch, especially in that courtroom, over and over and over again as my brother was murdered. Times, they're getting harder every day.
Hello and welcome to We the People. We've dedicated this episode of the show to George Floyd. We were asked, was justice served? Is systematic racism over or being swept under the table? I'm your host, Mila Java Maggi. From police brutality to gun policy in this episode. Thank you for staying with us.
When I look at George Floyd, I look at my dad, I look at my brothers, I look at my cousins, my uncles, because they are all black. I have a black father, I have a black brother, I have black friends. And I look at that and I look at how that could have been one of them. It's been nights I stayed up apologizing and apologizing to George Floyd for not doing more.
The rare moment of accountability gave the nation a small opportunity to exhale, with injustice raging on. The death of George Floyd triggered protests across the United States and the world in solidarity with his family, along with calls to end police brutality and systematic racism running rampant within the U.S. law enforcement and justice system.
And I'm so happy. I'm so happy right now. God, if you could just feel every beat of my heart, you know. I'm glad.
What's his name?
God!
What's his name?
God!
Yet, it's crucial not to represent the latest verdict as a panacea for structured racism. In other words, the system may want to portray Chauvin as an isolated racist in the police department, while in reality, white police officers targeting African Americans on racial grounds abound. We have Dr. Jared Ball with us to delve deeper into the case. He's a professor of African American and African Diaspora Studies at Morgan State University, also an author and radio host. Dr. Ball, welcome to our program.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Dr. Ball, what does the outcome of the George Floyd case mean for the nation's struggle to tackle racial injustice in America?
Well, in reality, it means very, very little. And we've already seen just shortly before the verdict came down on Derek Chauvin, Makia Bryant was killed. We saw just the other day Andrew Brown killed. In North Carolina, right around the corner, we saw Dante Wright killed. And of course, in Chicago, we saw 13-year-old Adam Toledo killed. So in terms of real-time, practical, lived experience, reality, the trial means very little.
May 25th, 2020, Chicago Avenue in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Floyd is arrested after allegedly passing a counterfeit $20 bill at a Cub Foods grocery store. 17 minutes into the arrest, and Floyd is now unconscious. He is handcuffed face down in the street with Chauvin kneeling on his neck.
You're a tough guy. You're a tough guy, huh?
I love y'all ass.
He's a tough guy. He's not even resisting arrest, bro. Bro, but why you just sitting there? He ain't doing nothing now. Put him in the car. It ain't about drugs, bro. Y'all understand that, but you don't gotta have his hand in his neck, bro. He is human, bro. But I'm saying he could put him in the car.
Onlookers fail to call for help or convince the aggressive cop to let him breathe. Officers take no action to treat him. But the footage capturing his demise is about to cause international outcry.
In the upcoming days, Chauvin would first be fired by the Minneapolis Police Department, arrested and charged with murder. Our next guest is Garland Nixon, a radio talk show host and political analyst with over 20 years of experience in law enforcement and currently serving on the National Board of Directors for the American Civil Liberties Union. Mr. Nixon, welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm very happy to be on.
Thank you. So what does Chauvin's conviction mean?
In my opinion, it doesn't mean anything. And, you know, certainly there is the natural euphoria whenever something like this happens that seems, you know, positive. And, of course, it is positive. But in my opinion, in a case where it's so blatantly obvious that this was a murder, that this was it for all of the world to see, I don't feel good about the outcome. I just feel that the outcome is exactly what it should have been. And the fact that we're discussing this outcome, the fact that people were concerned as to whether Derek Chauvin would be found guilty, in my opinion, demonstrates that we have a long way to go. So I don't see this as a, you know, the end of the struggle. I see it as representative of how bad things are in America for people of color, for, as Malcolm X referred to us, for our internal people who are, you know, trapped in our internal colonies.
It takes some 10 months for a trial to begin, with Minneapolis and the rest of the nation on edge while Black Lives Matter protests continue. After a three-week trial, Chauvin is ultimately convicted of all the three criminal counts he was facing. Up to 40 years in prison for second-degree murder, up to 25 years for third-degree murder, and up to 10 years for second-degree manslaughter.
Is there a motion on behalf of the state?
They would move to have the court revoke the defendant's bail and remand him into custody pending sentencing.
Bail is revoked, bond is discharged, and the defendant is remanded to the custody of the Hennepin County Sheriff. Anything further?
Aye.
Thank you.
Derek Chauvin rises. His eyes had been flicking. He watched intently. He is now handcuffed and led away, remanded into custody, having been found guilty of three charges.
In reality, the sentence could be reduced to as short as 15 years. The police department Chauvin used to work for abandoned him. Minneapolis Police Chief Medaria Arredondo even testified in the trial that the former officer's use of force against Floyd had exceeded the guidelines of police training.
I don't think anybody who's looking at this situation here seriously could suggest that this is a victory or a proof or a sign of even advance. Again, those who paid any attention to the trial or the reporting of the trial saw a situation where Chauvin, who had overwhelming evidence against him, was thrown under the bus, so to speak, even by his own leadership, where his own police chief went out of his way in the mind of at least some of us to make it clear that Chauvin is to be seen as the exception to the rule, as anomalous, or as, again, something that could be corrected, as the often used phrase here, the one bad apple. But in reality, Chauvin, as it was also made clear through his situation or positioning as a trainer of other police, was anything but anomalous, but was in fact the rule, or as others have put it, he was the feature and not the bug.
Cases of police brutality against people of color did not often end like this. Between the Chauvin trial on March 29, 2020 and now, tens of people have been killed by law enforcement officers nationwide. Yet Chauvin's case got so much attention because the world could see for itself what actually happened on that day.
Historical protest. I'm sure this is one of the biggest protests in history. It's for sure the biggest protest against racism, against police violence.
What is your purpose for being here? If you want to believe that we in the Netherlands do not have a problem with race, you should go ahead and go home.
I really believe that the problems that they have is nothing to do with a few bad apples. It's an institutional problem, and it has to be addressed.
Some African Americans behind the prosecution of Chauvin were in a celebratory mood after the trial, although many reminded the nation that justice is yet to materialize for the people of color. It is not common in the United States to see guilty verdicts against police officers killing black people. Yet, if he had somehow escaped justice, a serious unrest could have unraveled.
I do not believe that you can get justice in America from the American government unless you can get justice everywhere. Here's the example, the analogy that I use. You know, if a man goes to the bar and he gets drunk and he gets in a fight, And then on the way home, he gets in an argument with another driver and he gets in a fight. And then he gets out of his car at his home and he gets in an argument and he gets in a fight with his next door neighbor. When he comes home, he's going to be violent and abusive to his family because he has a violent and abusive nature.
Chauvin's conviction is highly unlikely to represent a turning point in the African Americans' struggle to attenuate racial profiling, police brutality, and anti-black hate. It rather represents a random and single case in which justice has been served. It also raises questions about the functionality of the U.S. justice system, particularly when it comes to the cases where it has to hold a white cop accountable for killing an innocent black man.
Οι εργαζόμενοι, οι νέοι, ο λαός των ΗΠΑ έχουν κάθε δικαίωμα να δηλώνουν ενάντια στη βαρβαρότητα και την καταστολή της Αμερικανικής κυβέρνησης.
It was immediately clear to any fair-minded person that Chauvin murdered Floyd, but it took nearly a year for the U.S. justice system to come to that conclusion. Therefore, the Floyd story, one of police brutality, injustice, and of course corruption, is bound to continue.
What is called the American justice system moves slowly, in most cases, just as a practical matter. But in reality, as often is the case, attempts are made to delay the presentation of facts and trials so as to allow public sentiment to change or at least calm down. In the hopes that the results either will go better for the defendant or subsequent to their conviction that at least, or potential acquittal, probably even more so, that the uproarious response would be limited or somehow suppressed or reduced.
Gun violence and police brutality are commonly reported in the United States, and recently it has claimed yet another life. This time, a 13-year-old Hispanic boy shot dead in Chicago. Adam Toledo was downed by the bullet fired by Officer Eric Stillman, who chased him down an alley after Toledo and his friend started shooting at a car.
Officer Stillman yelled at Adam to show if he is unarmed.
Show me your head!
A second later, Adam's right arm moves. Something appears to be in his hand. Another second later, at 2:38 and 40 seconds, Adam raises both his hands, empty, into the air. Then, he is shot. By 2:38:41, the 13-year-old is on the floor dying.
Decree after a Department of Justice investigation obliged Chicago to make hundreds of changes in policing as it found a decades-long record of racism and abuse by Chicago police. So how could the U.S. police be held accountable?
I've argued to the people who are marching, whether it's Black Lives Matter or various other groups that are fighting for equality in America, that the difference between our foreign policy and our domestic policy is grammatical and nothing else. The United States has fought around the world to stop the International Criminal Court from holding our troops responsible for war crimes in Afghanistan, Iraq, and other countries. So if they will not hold, if our government will not hold our military personnel responsible for violence against people in other countries, they certainly will not do it here. What we're seeing is a reflection of how our empire works.
Trust in police departments is in short supply among the people of color, including the Latin community in the U.S., and that appears unlikely to change. The Biden-Harris administration has been perforated on issues of crime and lawlessness in the streets. Their record on gun control and gun confiscation is not shining, according to most Americans.
I've seen with my own two eyes what a bullet can do to the human body. I've held hands with the hands of parents who have lost a child. I have seen children who were traumatized by the loss of a parent or sibling. And I have fought my entire career to end this violence and to pass reasonable gun safety laws. Time and again, as progress has stalled, we've all asked, what are we waiting for?
There's reportedly widespread public support for tougher gun laws. However, ambitious measures on that path are suppressed in the US political system. Biden has a limited plan for guns, but of course, he will have to encounter some of the most powerful organizations in America. Whether the US gun policy is set to change is yet to be seen. But what could the black people do? Mr. Ball.
There is no other solution other than black communities, brown communities, so-called communities of color in this country have to organize politically, have to organize with a certain level of radicalism and militancy to, again, start with self-protection units in their own communities, self-defensive units, and then the development of platforms, politicians, and political campaigns to assume political power that will give community control over policing and redirect resources differently so that those communities can be sustained and develop in a more healthy and holistic, humane way.
Gun violence and police brutality will unfortunately continue in the country. Their deep-rooted issues mingled with racism existing not just in the police force, but among some of the people. Let's hear from the man himself.
Our young generation is clearly lost, man. Clearly lost, man. Like, I don't even know what to say no more, man. Like, you youngsters just going around, just busting guns in crowds, kids getting killed, you know, and it's clearly the generation after us, man. That's so lost, man.
On this episode of We the People, I'm joined by justice journalist Chuck Mody. He's a sports writer and a columnist for Deadspin. Chuck, thanks for being with us. Now, racism in U.S. policing is certainly nothing new. In fact, it's been a defining characteristic since inception, when so-called slave patrols were among the earliest iterations of American cops. Over the past several decades, there have been many high-profile cases of racist police terror, with the infamous beating of Rodney King by the LAPD being among the most notorious, but almost none of them has resulted in a conviction of a police officer, until now. So Chuck, what was it about this recent case that allowed for a cop, Derek Chauvin, to finally face consequences for the murder of George Floyd?
Well, the circumstances are definitely unique, Wyatt. First of all, most of these other cases, you don't have a 9.5 minute video, and we won't have a 9.5 minute video for the next killing. They're usually more bang bang. So that is unique in and of itself. The jurors saw the torture that was happening. Another unique aspect is that this murder was so ugly, was so devastating, that actual police officers testified against Chauvin. And that is so incredibly rare. So even in reaching the verdict, you needed the validation from other police officers, including the police chief, including the head of training, including officers, to validate what our eyes could tell us very easily in those 9 minutes, if you could make it through. So this was unique, and I don't believe you can take anything away as far as, is this some new day in accountability? Because you're not going to have another case quite like this. The very few times the officer has come back, like the Danziger Bridge shootings in 2005 post-Katrina, another officer will turn someone in, you may get something, but you can't take anything away.
So if, as you say, this doesn't necessarily mean that there's a new day in police accountability, what does it mean exactly? And what do you make of the idea that I've heard from some organizers that this conviction really boils down to the unprecedented wave of public pressure that we saw with last summer's historic Black Lives Matter protests?
That idea is absolutely true. If we go back to the beginning of the video, the DA, Mike Freeman, wasn't arresting Derek Chauvin. It took an uprising. People all across the country uprising, including in Minneapolis, to really get the message across to force the arrest of Derek Chauvin. The people did that. Without that uprising, Derek Chauvin is probably walking like so many other people, Malton Sterling in Louisiana, despite incredible video. But those were sustained protests, and we hadn't seen protests so sustained for so long. And then a lot of white people came out of these protests, too. I don't want to underestimate that as well. So you had a new crowd. You had new pressure that was going on, and that certainly made a difference. While it made a difference in that case, we also know during the Derek Chauvin trial, a whole myriad of other individuals were killed or brutalized by police.
Right. It feels like not a day goes by that there's not another police killing where race seems to play a key role. In the past week, we've seen the police gun down people like 16-year-old Micaiah Bryant in Columbus, Ohio, Andrew Brown in North Carolina. I think the big question here is, when does it end? If not now, if this isn't a turning point, is there any light at the end of the tunnel here?
Well, it seemed like it increased. You just mentioned Andrew Brown, and there was protest for him in North Carolina today. We know about Dante Wright a couple of weeks ago in the Minneapolis Brooklyn Center. There were protests. We know Adam Toledo in Chicago, who, as he's putting his hands up, was shot. And this doesn't even the fact that the officer who shot Jacob Blake went back on duty last week barely made the news. It was a blip. And I could go on and on. There was a black lieutenant who was pepper sprayed by cops. We've seen these videos every single day. So whatever the verdict did in any or didn't do, it did not stop police killing. It did not stop police brutality. So I think what you're seeing is you're seeing continued protests. You're seeing a protest in North Carolina, as I just mentioned. In D.C., there have been protests all week. I've covered three protests. And there was one in regards to Micaiah Bryant. There was one in regards to police terror in general. And then on Saturday, there was one again. But it was specifically not just police accountability, but it showed a distinction that the protesters want to defund police. That's the language we're hearing, or abolish the police. And they're going far beyond the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act that we're hearing on TV. So one protester had said on Saturday that the D.C. police has a $543 million budget. We need to cut that budget. And also made the remark that $43 million was moved this year from Department of Health in D.C. so that there was no problem defunding health services. There's no problem defunding schools. There's no problem defunding Social Security. But when that same conversation goes on to people getting away with murder, literally, then it becomes a problem. And this is the disconnect between the protester in the street and what we're hearing at the administrative and presidential level.
Yeah, I think it's no surprise that we are seeing that disconnect between progressive activists and the Biden administration continue to grow. Well, we want to thank Chuck Modiano so much for joining us tonight. We want to thank viewers at home for tuning in for Press TV's We the People. In Washington, D.C., I'm Wyatt Reed.
It's no surprise that violence in the streets could cause even more police brutality, while racism and xenophobia against minorities such as Africans and Asians could play a big part in both. Chauvin will be sentenced on June 16, but the plight of minorities are not to lessen. It remains to be seen whether efforts for a fair society will start to pay off. I'm your host, Mila Java Magi. Please join us again next week on We the People.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
Due to concerns about blood clots, a number of countries have postponed the use of AstraZeneca vaccine, while Denmark has halted its use. Meanwhile, the United States has millions of doses of it, but has not approved its use for its domestic population. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written by Andrew Salmon titled "The Lethal Risks of Global North Vaccine Hoarding." The article was published by the Asia Times Daily. Please stay tuned. A leading vaccine expert suggested recently that countries holding but not using doses of the controversial AstraZeneca vaccine should release them so they can be supplied to the developing world. Dr. Jeremy Kim, head of the Seoul-based International Vaccine Institute that supplies vaccines across the developing world, said, "We need all the vaccines we have," adding, "If a country opts not to use a vaccine, it should provide it to an international mechanism that will distribute the vaccine." His suggestion came hours after the United States claimed that it will release 60 million AstraZeneca doses to other countries. However, regulatory clearance is still pending, and it is not known which countries will be the recipients. Due to concerns about blood clots, a number of countries have postponed the use of the vaccine, while Denmark has halted its use. Meanwhile, the U.S. has millions of doses of it, but has not approved its use for its domestic population. However, Kim noted that, in defiance of concerns, other advanced countries such as South Korea and the United Kingdom are proceeding with mass AstraZeneca vaccinations. Referring to the global initiative that supplies COVID-19 vaccines to developing nations at reduced or no cost, he said, "It is important for COVAX to have as much vaccine as possible." Kim said, "We know that Africa and Latin America and South Asia have tremendous problems," adding, "And even in countries that don't have explosive outbreaks, they have the potential to become so." Urgency is essential for two reasons. One is the highest carnage the virus is wreaking in India, Brazil, and elsewhere. The other is the unknown lifespan of AstraZeneca shot. Kim said shelf life is something a company determines over time, and this is not a vaccine we had 10 years ago with a lot of data, so we don't have a good answer, adding, "Companies will periodically take the vaccine out and subject it to testing. They are extending the shelf life as we go along." Kim, who spoke previously to Asia Times in March, made his suggestion while briefing foreign reporters in Brazil. In a wide-ranging representation and question and answer session, Kim addressed vaccine supply bottlenecks, equitable distribution, the risks posed by ongoing mass outbreaks in the developing world, and some possible silver linings to the crisis. Citing data from countries supplying vaccines, Kim said, "Despite widespread global impatience at the rate of supply, some 7.2 billion doses of the currently in use vaccines should have been produced by the first half of this year. By the end of this year, that number should rise to 12.6 billion, and in 2022, there should be 30 billion doses available, more than enough to take care of the entire global population of 7.8 billion. Still, Kim admitted that this was rosy data. Regardless of manufacturing projections, there remain major questions about supply bottlenecks. Kim admitted there are difficulties with scaling up production. He gave the example of Pfizer, which had to temporarily hold production to massively upscale capabilities, which caused frustrating delays. There have also been snafus, such was at the Baltimore plant that mixed up ingredients of AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson vaccines, reportedly spoiling 15 million doses of the latter. And vaccine nationalism has warped supply chains. India, a major manufacturer of vaccines, has indefinitely halted overseas shipments of AstraZeneca to deal with its domestic catastrophe. Getting wide access to vaccines is not simply about being prosperous. Some countries, particularly those which were successful at pandemic containment, were late to order and/or slow to approve vaccines. For example, according to the Financial Times Global Vaccination Tracker, G10 economies, Japan and South Korea are, in terms of percentage of population vaccinated, behind Bangladesh, Dominican Republic, Mexico, Nepal, and Rwanda. Kim said, even so, as a general rule, the wealthier the country, the more likely they are to have vaccinated significant parts of their population. Kim told Asia Times in March, a number of high-income nations fast-tracked regulatory approval and made early pre-orders for vaccines. These countries were assisted by having highly regarded regulatory authorities with the credibility to swiftly approve vaccines. Customarily, countries which lack top-tier regulatory bodies follow the lead set by the most advanced nations. Given the interconnectivity of modern human life, it is essential that vaccinations spread beyond the first world. Kim noted that U.S. intelligence has recently restated that the U.N. had already said, "No one is safe until everyone is safe." Kim said, if high-income countries corner global supply, it will be a disaster. Modeling suggests it may result in doubling the number of COVID deaths worldwide. Kim suggested the real danger lies in the developing world, sub-Saharan Africa, Latin America, and South Asia. Kim's biggest fear concerned the race between vaccinations and mutant strains of the virus. Runaway outbreaks such as the UK's and currently Brazil's and India's were mutations. He warned these mutations are less sensitive to vaccines and could determine the vaccines we now have. Kim said, a year ago we did not have any vaccinations. Now 2 billion doses should be available to COVAX by the end of 2021. While that would only cover 20% of the vaccinations necessary, it should protect the high-risk populations, healthcare workers, and the aged. Kim said, I think COVAX will succeed, but I would like to succeed better. Adding, the prediction is 20% of global needs will be met in 2021, but we have to talk about what countries will need it more desperately. That will be the true test of COVAX. The Global North efforts to assist the Global South must extend beyond supplying vaccines to upgrading medical infrastructure to enable efficient distribution, storage, and administration and monitoring. He said, we don't know how big the infections are and what mutations are emerging in Africa, adding, this can put the vaccines we have developed at risk. We have to invest in surveillance. However, while he emphasized the need to get vaccines to the developing world, Kim warned that one demand currently being aired is not going to be of help. With massive outbreaks underway in Brazil and India, and infection and death tolls is still climbing, Kim admitted that he is not as upbeat about the conclusion of the battle against the virus as he was in 2020. He said, if you asked a year ago, I would have said we could vaccinate and control it with 10 billion doses, adding, but now, with the generation of mutations and explosive outbreaks and ensuring equitable access to vaccines, I am not so positive. COVID-19 poses mortal perils to the aged, but minimal risks to young. This dynamic may help shift the world's conventional attitude toward vaccinations. He said 80% of children around the world get vaccinations that WHO recommends, adding, now we need to change from pediatric immunization to universal immunizations. That change agent could be the current pandemic. Kim said COVID could be a silver lining in the move to lifetime universal vaccinations.
Ministry. 10 years and a global war later, Israel is still not able to neutralize its front line with Damascus. With more than 500 illegal Israeli strikes on different parts of Syria, an Iron Dome recognized as the most effective on the planet, and yet Syria's missiles landed in the occupied Naqab Desert near the infamous Dimona. What is even more interesting is that the Israeli occupation regime immediately deemed that this was not an attack, but rather an errant Syrian anti-aircraft missile that had been fired at an Israeli jet during an airstrike on targets in the Syrian Golan Heights. Humor me here. I will give you a timeline of what we know happened, but then I have some simple questions. The Syrian Ministry of Defense announced that its air defenses had responded to an aggression carried out by the Israeli entity against Syrian Arab Army targets near Damascus. Syria's air defenses dropped most of the Israeli missiles. Less than an hour later, at 2 a.m. on Thursday, April 22, incoming rocket sirens were triggered in the northern Naqab Desert in the area near Israel's Dimona nuclear reactor, followed by massive explosions that could be heard throughout much of occupied Palestine. At 3 a.m., Israel's occupation forces spokesperson Jonathan Conricus told Reuters that an errant Syrian missile struck the area around Dimona, but the reactor was not hit by the strike. Now, can someone explain to me how a surface-to-air missile can travel a distance of 250 kilometers from Damascus to Dimona all the way in the occupied Naqab Desert? And why did Israeli jets conduct a second round of airstrikes in Syria after this errant missile landed a few kilometers away from their secret nuclear plant site? And how much of a coincidence was it that a powerful explosion rocked an Israeli missile factory near occupied Al-Quds just hours before the Dimona incident? We'll try answering these questions right here on the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Sirens went off in Dimona town in the Palestinian-occupied Naqab Desert in the early hours of Thursday, April 22, which is home to Israel's infamous nuclear reactor, indicating a possible incoming attack. A missile landed only a few kilometers away from the Dimona plant, which Israel immediately deemed as a missile that has lost its track from the Syrian side. Supposedly, it was a surface-to-air missile that was targeting an Israeli jet raiding Damascus and ended up somehow falling 250 kilometers away from its initial target. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mohammed Abed, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Mr. Mohammed. Now, Israel immediately declared hours after the missile landed near Dimona that it was an errant Syrian missile, while Syria only officially declared that it fired anti-aircraft missiles against the Israeli jet that was targeting Damascus at that time. Was the Israeli scenario of a missile that lost its track some 250 kilometers away from the initial target a plausible one for you?
Well, no, to say, tell you the truth. It's not even, I think, plausible to many people in the world. Any observer would note that this range of error, if we are to call it this way, would stop us against believing. And the issue that we had a previous case in which an errant surface-to-air missile landed near the Lebanese-Palestinian borders. So to have this range of error, which is about 250 kilometers, I think this weakens the whole story. And the issue of that the Israelis are not even publishing anything about it in today's press, for instance, and just had one unified scenario that is not that much acceptable for a missile that would lose its way and so. So from many angles, you don't find this as a plausible narrative.
Well, Mr. Mohammed, many serious questions are clashing right now at the decision-making tables inside of the Israeli entity. The main question is the nature of this so-called incident, as the Israelis are calling it, and the objectives behind it. What do you think was the main objective of hitting so close to Dimona?
Well, you have to take into account all the players that are engaged in this sort of conflict, which is sometimes on a low fire, but sometimes tensions heighten and we see explosions, for instance, like the one we saw on this very day, within 24 hours of the incident of the missile. I mean the Tamir facility, which is a factory of manufacturing missiles near residential areas, by the way. There was an explosion that was taped on many on phones, and the images, the footage toured the world. I mean, you can see it very easily, but still nobody talks about this anymore. You have to take into account this conflict, which is basically taking place between the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Israeli entity. You have a factory that manufactures missiles and do some tests. And the closeness, as I mentioned earlier, to the residential areas, you had this case of an explosion of a test, which is, remains a little, not a little, a lot of questions are raised about it.
Mind you, it happened just hours before the actual missile that landed near Dimona.
Yes. And we come back to the missile. So here you have to take all the players. I mean, the Islamic Republic, Syria. Is Syria trying to change the rules of engagement? As for the Israelis, whenever they like, are launching aggressions on Syria and doing so. Are the Iranians, and they don't want to declare it, taking revenge as for the attacks of Natanz and other Israeli aggressions within Iran or against Iranian targets? So you have to take into account all the players within this very live conflict that we see now.
Mm-hmm. Well, another question hovers around the Israeli intelligence and their defense capabilities, which were utter failure, very much of a failure following the landing of the missile at, quote, the safest place in the world. This is what the Mona mayor is saying. When on the same day, you just explained to us, just maybe if not the same day, just hours before, on Wednesday afternoon, we saw this huge explosion in the occupied Jerusalem area, which Israel's claim it's an accident that has happened inside of a missile factory inside its territories. How do you think this issue is being maybe discussed behind the closed doors, especially of the Israeli intelligence ones?
Yes, if we weren't within a case of enmity with the Israelis, we'd say, may God help them. Now, they are facing a lot of catastrophes. The attacks that they are launching whenever they want are backfiring. Now, we saw that the all the Iron Dome and whatever they call the Arrow missile interception and so, are failing in the face of one missile. So what is the case when hundreds, let's say the least, or thousands maybe of missiles land on the Palestinian occupied territories that are now occupied by the Israelis? So if these systems could not deal with one missile, so what is the case if hundreds of missiles are launched? And I'd like also to comment on this issue of the safest place in the world. I mean, mm-hmm. How can it be as such if you cannot prevent and intercept one missile? What is the case when you have, and this is a main geopolitical change that we've seen within the past 10 years. In the past, Israel used to launch aggressions against all the countries around the Palestine. I mean, they would have no reaction for that. They could do whatever they want. But now we see that they are not able even to launch an aggression against Gaza, against Lebanon. And now maybe we are witnessing a change of rules of engagement as for this missile. Whoever is the one that the party that launched it, probably will not no longer see Israeli attacks against Syria that go unpunished. So all this within the region is taking place. Also, we have to take into account the negotiations that are taking place, the indirect negotiations between the Islamic Republic and the United States, and the Israelis being unpleasant about it at all, mm-hmm. and they are all expressing their that they do not want the return to the agreement, nuclear agreement.
Hence, why we saw a lot of clashes, maybe some sort of a shadowy Cold War between Israel and Iran in the Mediterranean and the Red Sea. But the failure, specifically here inside of the occupied Palestinian territories, occupied by the Israeli entity, the failure of the Patriot system to intercept that supposedly surface-to-air missile, we are not sure, and experts are saying that is not even the case here, but the failure of this system, which now just is some sort of an additional loophole to the Israeli intercepting system that is said to be the most effective in the world. We are seeing here Syria and its allies, an entire axis of resistance building upon this incident, having more options on the table, on their own table. Are we at a new phase of countering Israeli attacks against any component of the allied forces of the resistance in West Asia?
Yes, probably we will be seeing this change in the political and in the situation on the ground. As I told you earlier, in the past, I mean, you used to have Israel come and raid Lebanon whenever they wanted. The Palestinian Gaza Strip was not liberated then, but after the liberation also they launched aggressions whenever they want. So this serves the theory of those who say that the Israelis will not be deterred unless you use force against them. And this is one thing that we probably are witnessing nowadays. Now, if you are, imagine yourself one of those who are in the think tanks or in the people who are decision-making within the Israeli entity, and you are facing such a situation. In the past, you used to do whatever you want. Now you cannot even launch aggression against the weakest party, as you said, because Syria now, because of the universal aggression that took place against it, this universal war that was supported by at least 80 countries against Syria. So Syria is now the weakest part of the axis of the resistance. So now Syrians probably will be preventing Israel from launching an aggression. This may lead us to another point, which is more strategic. Mm-hmm. The first creation of Israel was to be the West's barracks in the region. And even, by the way, President Biden said this while he was explaining why he supports Israel. Mm-hmm. He said it is cheaper than having any war ship in the Mediterranean, for instance.
Well, it remains to be seen what will happen next, Mr. Mohammed, especially that the U.S. military itself is being rained upon by missiles inside of Iraq. They can't get a hold of themselves. They want to try and get hold of their own ally here. That's going to be a big issue and a big challenge for them. And I want to thank you very much, Mohammed Abed, political commentator, for being with us to talk about this attack on Dimona, which Israel is deeming just a missile that lost track. Stay with us next. We will be talking about the Revolutionary Guards drone footage that is showing the U.S. aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard has released precise drone footage of a U.S. Navy aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf, aired on Press TV on Wednesday. The video, which shows the aircraft carrier with warplanes, helicopters, and other military equipment, was reportedly recorded by a four-strong drone squadron, providing real-time and precise details of the U.S. warship. The video comes as the U.S. is still refusing to remove all sanctions off of the Iranian population, as renewed diplomacy are underway to revive the abandoned 2015 nuclear deal. More details about that in this following report.
Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard released drone footage of a U.S. aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf and clip of a bomber drone test flight on Wednesday, at a time when the Vienna-based talks between world powers to revive the 2015 nuclear deal were underway. The Islamic Revolutionary Guard released strikingly precise and close footage of the American aircraft carrier captured by the elite forces' drones during an overflight of the vessel in the Persian Gulf, vividly portraying its state-of-the-art advancements in the field of drone technology. The footage was undated, but was described by regional media as showing remarkably close details of warplanes and other military aircraft and equipment on the U.S. aircraft carrier. The second part of the footage, entitled Precision Attacks by the Revolutionary Guards, showed kamikaze drones as they are hitting various targets, including a tank. The UAVs are seen slamming into the targets with surgical accuracy and smashing them into fragments. It is not the first time the Islamic Revolutionary Guard displayed its achievements and prowess in drone technology. However, this video was broadcasted on Iranian outlets at a time when the U.S. is still refusing to remove all sanctions off of the Iranian population, as renewed diplomacy are underway to revive the abandoned 2015 nuclear deal. Diplomats from Britain, China, France, Germany, Iran, and Russia have been meeting regularly since earlier this month to discuss reviving the 2015 nuclear deal, while U.S. diplomats are participating indirectly in the talks. Tehran firmly refuses any direct talks with the U.S. before all sanctions are lifted, and the result of the lifting is felt by the government and the people. The Islamic Republic has made it clear that it would by no means settle for the suspension, easing, or extending the waiver of sanctions, repeating what Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has always echoed. The bans should be removed in their entirety, and Iran will wait to verify of the sanctions removal before returning to its nuclear obligations under the deal.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Tehran is Dr. Hamed Mousavi, political science professor at Tehran University. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Mousavi. Now, what is the Islamic Republic of Iran trying to say by showing this drone footage of the U.S. Aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf at a time when before we even mentioned the nuclear deal, at a time when the regional waters are witnessing a shadowy cold war between Iran and Israel?
Well, I think, first of all, it's a show of strength by Iran. Iran essentially is trying to say that if it is attacked, it has the capacity to respond both to Israeli forces as well as American forces in the region. And from Tehran's perspective, the attack that happened in Natanz, the Americans were also shared a responsibility for it, even though they denied any involvement. We have to remember that even if the Americans were not directly involved, the Israelis, I think they got a green light from the Americans. This happened, the attack on Natanz happened exactly when the U.S. Secretary of Defense was meeting Israeli officials, and the Americans, after the attack, did not denounce the attack, or they did not criticize Israel. They only specified that they weren't directly responsible. So from Tehran's perspective, if Iran comes under attack, then it has the capacity to respond to both the Americans as well as the Israelis.
Well, another aspect of the video that was released by the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps showed kamikaze drones hitting various targets, including one tank, with very much accurate targets, showcasing Iran's state-of-the-art technology in the field of drones. It is worth mentioning that this video was released just 1 week after the Israeli Natanz attack and just 1 day before the Dimona attack inside of the Israeli territory, obviously the occupied Palestinian territories, though the plant was allegedly not hit. We have no evidence of that. Is this phase two of this shadowy war, this shadowy Cold War, if you will, between Israel, or rather just another threat against U.S. presence in the region in general?
Well, I think Iran is trying to show that it has asymmetrical capabilities in responding to both the Israelis as well as the Americans. I don't think we can really distinguish between the Americans and the Israelis, even in this Biden administration, because the Americans have been very much supportive of Israeli policy in the region, and we haven't seen any real changes regarding the Trump administration's policy towards Israel. So in that regard, the fact that the Israelis as well as the Americans have been attacking Iran on various fronts has really escalated the situation. I don't think Iran wants a regional war here. In fact, Iran has showed a lot of, if you will, it has shown a lot of restraint in the past year. We had the assassination of Iranian scientists at the end of December. We had the attack on Natanz, which happened actually less than a year before another attack on the same Iranian facilities. And during all this time, Iran has actually been trying to calm the situation. But at the same time, I think Iran wants to show that if push comes to shove, then it does have the capability to respond. Regarding the attack near Dimona, first of all, it's important to note that Israel's Iron Dome system was not able to intercept the missile. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it missed the Dimona plant, I think maybe it was on purpose. I think the aim was not to hit Dimona, but was rather to show that there is the capability, either by Iran or Hezbollah, mm-hmm. to target sensitive Israeli systems if, in fact, a war should start between Iran and Israel.
Dr. Mousawi, the timing of the drone footage coincided with the ongoing meetings in Vienna between Britain, China, France, Germany, Iran, and Russia, who were there to discuss reviving the 2015 nuclear deal. But would such footage bring a leverage to the Iranian position, or rather would very much maybe hurt the talks at this time?
Well, I think the Israeli attack on Natanz had maybe two purposes. One was to derail the talks, because we know the Israelis do not want the talks to reach an agreement. But at the same time, I think the Israelis were trying to establish leverage for the Americans, and the fact that they were trying to hurt Iran's enrichment capabilities. But in reality, the attack actually had a reverse effect, because right after the attack, Iran started enrichment of 60%, essentially giving Iran leverage in the talks with the Americans. And the fact that these kinds of footage, as well as the attack on Dimona, is showing is that Iran is not a weak regional player here. It does have the means and the capabilities to respond. The fact that it has not responded in a forceful manner is because Iran does not want war. Nevertheless, we have to remember that restraint from the Iranian side cannot hold on forever. The Biden administration has to understand that if they don't bar the Israelis from such kind of attacks, then there is a very real possibility of war in the region. Mm-hmm. And this is a very dangerous scenario.
We are seeing that U.S. diplomats are not participating directly in these talks because Tehran firmly refuses any direct talks with the U.S. before all sanctions are lifted, and the result of lifting of that those sanctions are felt by both the government and the nation, the people of Tehran. What are Iran's options in the event that the U.S. refuses to lift the sanctions, then rather choose instead to ease those sanctions?
Well, I think from Iran's position specified by Ayatollah Khamenei,